This is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
Hey everybody, it's Aaron Norris with the Norris Group. Today we've got Sterling Jawitz of Common, and he is head of real estate strategic partnerships at Common, where he is in charge of growing and maintaining relationships with large-scale real estate developers, owners, and investors in all target markets. As a first employee of Common, Sterling spent more than a year as head of real estate acquisitions, focusing on real estate acquisitions, strategy, and project-specific analysis. And then prior to Common, he focused on real estate development in New York City, specializing in high-density co-living spaces that provided both social and professional development services and amenities. He also worked in real estate capital markets, primarily with institutional investors looking to deploy equity and debt.
Well, this is a really great, I guess, segue into competition. Is there a lot of people in this space looking to do the same thing right now?
That's a great question. So there's a few folks in the space right now. Obviously, there's WeLive. There are a few other startups that have popped up, whether that be on the East Coast in New York. There are a few popping up in San Francisco and in Los Angeles. And then some of the larger players are folks that are international groups out of Europe, out of Asia, out of India, which are primarily focused in their own regional markets. A few of them have started exploring opportunities in the United States. We're very excited about that. We view co-living as a developing asset class, similarly to the way self-storage or student housing developed into asset classes in the last 10 to 20 years. If we were the only player in the space, it would be a great business, but it wouldn't be an asset class. And so for us, the more people who are entering into co-living really proves out that, you know, this is the way that people are choosing to live, and this is going to change the way that we design residential real estate going forward for a very, very long time. And so we get excited about hearing new players entering into the space. People who are entering into co-living today are getting a significant premium for entering in at such an early stage, as they did in those other asset classes that I mentioned earlier. And as you see the asset class develop, you're in theory and most likely going to see a compression in cap rates that I think they're going to trade at. Mm-hmm. And you're going to see a tremendous amount of value being created there.
Let's talk a little bit about the different markets you're in. What different city metropolitan areas are you currently located in?
Yeah, no problem. So we launched in New York, and we're currently operating in New York City, Washington, D.C., Chicago, and in the Bay Area. So in the Bay Area, we both have San Francisco, SoMa, as well as in Oakland.
Any expanding into other markets right now, or are you really just focused on those four main metropolitans?
Well, we're definitely growing our real estate presence in those existing markets, but we have announced a few other markets that we will be entering into over the course of the next year or two, and I can share two of those with you. We have announced some projects in Los Angeles that will be opening up throughout 2018 and 2019. And we also have announced a project in New Orleans that will be opening up 2019 as well.
Wow.
And that's a very exciting ground-up development project.
Do you see micro-living and other shared housing? I laugh because there's one I've talked to them about the radio show before. It's a pod share, I think it is. So do you see those as competition or just different sort of asset classes on their own?
I think they're different. I think someone who's choosing to live in a micro unit is very different than someone who's choosing to live in a shared housing facility like Common. That being said, co-living or community experience-based living can exist throughout all of that. So I wouldn't say we would necessarily shy away from building these smaller micro units in some markets that might make more sense. But then the focus really becomes on creating that sense of community, whether it's in the physical space and creating those kind of extension of living room spaces, whether that be floor by floor or every other floor, but also on a programming sense. And I think from the research and study that I have done on the micro housing world that currently exists here in the United States, that's where they're ultimately kind of missing out on is the experience, is the community, is the technology, and in some regards, the design and providing all of that through design and technology.
It's interesting. You guys are somewhat new, starting just in 2015, but do you have a sense of your expected length of stay on average for your tenants?
So we're currently seeing just north of a 70, actually close to an 80% renewal rate on our 12-month agreements, which is even higher than traditional kind of market rate multifamily renewal, which is very, very exciting, which to us shows us that this is not transient housing. This is not something that people are coming to just to kind of get their feet wet and get, you know, acclimated to a city and then move out. They really view this as long-term housing. We can confidently say, based off of the data that we have, that people are going to stay north of 2 years average, probably closer to three.
I think this is a really great segue into the politics of it all, especially in markets like New York and California. The lack of housing has really just started to get political. There's lots of talk about everything from getting rid of rent control at the legislative level. What's been the response from cities that you're entering into? Are they excited about the concept?
Yeah, we've had a tremendous amount of positive responses, from the local community, whether it be local politicians, community members, really embracing what we are doing. In the state of California, we're only open in San Francisco. We are not open in Los Angeles yet. Of course, when we enter into a new market, we spend a lot of time meeting with local community leaders and meeting with local politicians. And then once the property is open, we very much try to engage with the local community, whether that be in local businesses, local events, and really trying to get our membership and our tenant base involved in the local community. But from the response that we've had so far in the markets that we're going into is, this is the type of housing that is very much needed. It is not, we don't design and build for this, but it's the way that people are choosing to live. It allows us to deliver more affordable housing than is currently achievable on the market. I wouldn't necessarily say affordable housing uppercase A, but affordable housing lowercase A. The price per head, as I mentioned, is significantly lower than if you were to go out and live on your own. The response has been tremendous. And it's about the work that we do and getting out ahead and really educating people on who we are, what we do, and why this is going to be good for the community.
You said something interesting about getting your tenants engaged in the community. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, no problem. So when it comes to programming and building out kind of, say, the common community, we really rely on our members to grow it organically. We're not necessarily on a daily basis hosting events and telling them they have to attend X, Y, and Z. But it's more about enabling and empowering them and giving them the tools that they need to grow the community that they want. At the same time, we obviously want to make sure that they are involved in the local community. So when we, every Sunday night, we host potluck dinners at our properties, and we're always getting it brought in. I guess it wouldn't necessarily be a potluck dinner, but we're having a dinner brought in from a local restaurant. We tend to try to get local community leaders or politicians to come in and meet and maybe even give a presentation or introduce themselves to people living in our properties. We give them neighborhood guides, and we give them tools that they can use to really understand how they can get more involved in the community, whether that be volunteer work, whether that just be local shops that they can go to, even if that's information on how to register to vote in local elections. These are just kind of things that little tools that we can provide them just to make sure that they feel part of not only the common community, but the greater community as a whole.
That's no small feat. That's a really big deal. I think that makes you guys very special. And I think it juxtaposes next to something like an Airbnb that has had such a difficult time getting into some of these larger metropolitan areas. So I know you're not in the Inland Empire. I'm based out of Riverside, but the sort of the co-living, specifically the student housing, has been a real problem. We've got four universities in one city, and the students got a little wild. We had landlords that were taking family rooms and creating three extra bedrooms, so you had eight students living there, and they throw block parties. So they actually regulated it. I think if you have more than two unrelated parties in the same house, you have to register, you have to get a license. I mean, this is a very different approach. You're bringing the politicians to you. You're not hiding anything. I just got back from New York, and I thought I was staying in one area, but it was sort of like, it felt like it was an illegal Airbnb. I was pretty much told, if you get caught, you have to pay a $500 fee. I'm like, wait a second, I didn't know that was going to happen. I wouldn't have signed up for that if that was the case. But so when somebody tries to compare you to Airbnb, this sounds very different.
Yeah, first of all, we're not short-term stay.
Correct.
Majority of people who are living in common are signing 12-month agreements. And if not, they're on 6 months agreements. But yeah, it's really about getting out ahead and educating people on who we are and what we do. And so they understand that these are going to be people who are going to be involved in the community and who are going to, be positive, and not going to be kind of that rowdy, debaucherous group that you alluded to.
So maybe you lose some fun points, but the brilliance isn't wasted on me. If you get community members that are interested and invested into where they're living, the likelihood of them staying longer goes up, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Why did you decide to choose the markets that you did?
Those are markets that really have significant, I would say, supply and demand constraints. We're seeing a tremendous amount of year-over-year job growth, population growth. You're seeing housing supply not being able to keep up with that. You're seeing a tremendous amount of increases in pricing year after year in rental housing. So these are kind of cities where it makes sense to be in. And you can kind of think of them as, kind of gateway NFL major U.S. cities are the obvious places where this makes sense. I can't blame that term. Someone in a meeting a few weeks ago used that term, and granted, I am not a big football, an avid football watcher. I can appreciate it.
Hey, no, fair, totally fair. Look at you giving kudos to other people. Your bonus points. You mentioned a lot more going forward was going to be new construction. I know it takes longer, but is that more of the ultimate goal, is to sort of build your own inventory instead of sort of renovating existing?
I mean, ultimately, I think our pipeline in the future is going to skew more and more towards ground up development, especially as we start doing larger projects. We, our homes today range anywhere from a 9-bedroom brownstone to 145 members in Boreham Hill in a new ground up construction project. As we scale the business, as we start growing our membership base and doing larger and larger projects, those are always going to skew towards ground up development. It is very difficult to kind of do an adaptive reuse project on, say, an existing office building and convert it into a co-living space where the unit economics make sense. Hmm. You have such large floor plates. You need to have legal light and air. Bedrooms for most markets need to have windows. For us, it's kind of a user experience thing that we would prefer. We don't like this idea of living in bedrooms that don't have windows. And so when you're thinking about taking an existing office building and with very, very large floor plates and being able to maximize density from a residential standpoint, it's very difficult. And so for larger projects, they really have to go towards ground up development. But that being said, we will always take a look at, and we will always continue to do adaptive reuse projects and redevelopment projects to the extent that the unit economics work.
One of the things that you mentioned was a background check, and I definitely wanted to make sure we touched on this, as risks. What are the risks of putting 4 to 5 unrelated strangers together in a building, and how do you manage that risk?
Yeah, no problem. So from the application process, we try to manage it up front, whether that be, we perform background checks, we perform criminal background checks. We're obviously doing it. People are going through an interview process. But really, when it comes down to being a hands-on property manager and understanding what is going on in the property. All of our members are directly connected to each other through a chat software, which allows them to speak to their suite mates, allows them to speak to their building mates, allows them to speak to anyone who lives in common. And for us, it's about kind of just being clued in on everything that is going on, making sure that people who live in common, if there is an issue, feel comfortable coming to us and talking to us about it. And then we have the right processes in place to deal with issues as they arise. I would say that, you know, today we're only 450 members. So we have been somewhat fortunate to really not have any serious problems come up, and we've been able to handle everything. But obviously, as we scale, right, we're going to be north of 1,000 members by the end of this year. You know, and by 2020, we're targeting 10,000. You know, if we're going to hit that, obviously we understand that there will be more problems will arise, and it's about us planning ahead. So how do we get ahead of these problems when we're at 3x and 10x the size that we are today?
Do you have property managers that live on site in all these properties?
Not on all of the properties. We do have local, we do have a team member that is in charge of the property and of the community that is, whether they be on site for a larger property or they manage, say, a portfolio of a handful of properties. But that person is always, you know, within an Uber ride or walking distance to all of the properties. And to the extent if by, say, zoning or by code, you're required to have a super or property manager on site, living on site. Of course, everything we do is to code, whether that be through the design process, the building process, the operation process. And so we will have someone on site if need be.
Have you guys ran into any code issues as far as the planning department, since it's a slightly new take? You're sort of expanding the number of people maybe that's going to be going to the buildings. Do they have any problem with this?
So today we really haven't had any issues. We have, as I said, with the local politicians, also have gotten out ahead and educated local, you know, the local department of buildings and inspectors and the appropriate parties on who we are, what we're doing, how what we are building is in line with local zoning codes. And we make sure that, you know, we consult with the appropriate legal counsel before entering into any market to make sure that we're crossing our T's and dotting our I's and that we're not going to have a violation or have something that, you know, that we build something that we didn't know kind of, you know, was at odds with zoning or at odds with some would cause some sort of violation. So we very much try in every instance to get out ahead of any problem, whether that be on the design front, on the permitting front, on the zoning front, kind of on all of it.
Have you had any cities approach you to please build more?
We have talked to a few cities about building housing for them and what it means to build affordable housing for them. I would say, though, it's very interesting is a few cities have talked to us about, you know, when the typical developer or affordable housing developer is building an affordable housing development, it's usually comprised of studios, ones and two bedroom apartments. And that's typically because the code is dictating what those price points need to be in terms of how they're tied to AMI. And that's kind of the extent that it covers. That being said, you're seeing a larger and larger part of the population that needs some form of government subsidy housing, being families and being these larger groups of people where larger units, 3, 4, 5, even 6-plus bedroom apartments would be incredibly, incredibly beneficial to them. And so we're actively, you know, we're always having conversations with people about how we can utilize our design and our layouts to deliver housing that's affordable, and whether that be uppercase A or lowercase A affordable housing.
Okay. What do you see as sort of the future of co-housing?
Co-living is nothing new. I mean, people have been living with roommates throughout all of history. And if you kind of look at the macroeconomic shifts that are happening in today's environment, it only kind of points to that growing. People are delaying marriage. So in the 1960s, the average age of marriage was somewhere or close to 23 years old. And today it's just shy of 30. People are seeking more flexible kind of work-life balance. People are becoming increasingly independent and are choosing access over ownership. So you're seeing kind of the sharing economy boom. People aren't buying homes. They aren't buying cars. Forbes ran a piece on access over ownership, and it was 78% of millennials would choose to spend money on an experience or an event over buying something. On top of that, you have a decrease in the number of people moving out to the suburbs year over year, and an increase of people who are moving into cities that are just becoming denser and denser, and the ability to build is not keeping up with the growing population. And people are choosing to live with roommates later in life. So people, you know, with marriage getting delayed and all those other things happening, people are living with roommates now, not only in their 20s, but in their 30s and even later. And so all of this points to co-living kind of not being a passing fad, but kind of being an emerging and growing asset class that's here to stay. I mean, you're seeing in most major markets, you're seeing a lot of, you know, rents are dramatically increasing a lot faster than incomes are growing. I believe from 2000 to 2010, we saw something like nationally, like rent increased 12% and median income fell by 7%. So all of that combined is kind of the perfect storm for delivering, you know, our solution, Common.
Well, and it's just really interesting. The way that you're approaching it is just pretty brilliant in the way that you're getting people to plant roots. I'm sure it's very well thought out, but I had no idea the level of detail you guys are going into creating experience. It says on the website, the board that you were talking about, the program, the technology is Slack. So the transparency as well, if people want to complain,
yeah.
it's out there for people to see. That's, I think most landlords are like, forget that. I don't want my tenants talking to each other.
I think that's really what sets us apart from other, you know, property management companies that exist. I mean, we're really trying to drive home this idea of knowing your neighbor and creating that sense of community and making those people feel like they're at a sense, you know, have a sense of home and have a sense of ownership over their space. But you can really only enable that if you have their ear, if they have a complaint, if they have a problem, if you're willing to listen and you're willing to solve their problem. And so for us, we do all of the repairs and maintenance or complaints or ticketing is all done, whether that be on Slack or on our website or through our membership portal. We have a very, very fast response rate where repairs and maintenance requests are getting fixed typically on the same day, definitely within 24 hours. We're responding to any ticket within 10 minutes,
wow.
Making sure that the member knows that we recognize that they're having a problem and that we're going to address it and take care of it within the next 24 hours. Back when we had a handful of properties open, I think we had 3 or 4 properties open. We were around 100 people in membership. Someone posted to the member chat Slack channel, wouldn't it be great if the common homes had blenders in them? And I believe that happened around at a 7 p.m. on a Tuesday. Not going to lie, 8 a.m. Wednesday, every suite in common had a blender in it. Now, it's a great example, but I'm not going to say that we would do that for everything. So we obviously, people come and they post that, you know, it'd be great if every suite had a garlic press. We're not going to run out and go and buy every suite a garlic press. There are certain things that people can, you know, you can create a shared goods room for a certain level of items, and people can kind of take them as they wish and return them when they're done using them. But I wanted to tell you that as an example of how we really care about the member experience, and we listen to them, we poll them. So one, a big kind of metric that's used in the consumer industry is Net Promoter Score, NPS. I'm sure if you don't know NPS, I'm sure you've participated in 101 of them. You get asked a question, how likely are you to recommend this product or service to a friend or family, 0 through 10? And we track that after they move in. We track it once they've been in the home for a few months. We track it after a half a year. We track it upon renewals. And it's just to make sure that people are enjoying the experience that they're having and they are enjoying living in common. And I can't think of any other property management company out there that cares at all about that.
I agree. Well, I just really appreciate your time. We've run out of time, unfortunately. Can you give the website one more time if people are looking to find out more about the company?
Yeah, no problem. It's Common, C-O-M-M-O-N.com.
Well, we'll check in every once in a while to figure out how things are going. And thank you so much for taking the time today, Sterling.
Thank you so much, Aaron. Really appreciate it.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.